as Haiti reels from last month's catastrophic earthquake, which left thousands without water, food, shelter and medicine. The U.S. deported some 86 Haitian asylum seekers Wednesday, including families and children under the age of 3. In a statement, Gerline Joseph, the co-founder of the Haitian Bridge Alliance, said, quote, "We're in utter disbelief. Hours after the 7.2 magnitude earthquake, President Joe Biden released a statement saying the United States was a friend of Haiti. A friend does not continuously inflict pain on another friend," she said. Meanwhile, the political turmoil in Haiti is growing after Prime Minister Ariel Henry replaced Haiti's justice minister Thursday, just days after firing a top public prosecutor who sought to charge Prime Minister Henry in connection with the July assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. The prosecutor, who also sought to prevent Henry from leaving Haiti, said the prime minister had communicated with a key suspect on the night Moïse was killed. On Wednesday, the head of Haiti's Council of Ministers resigned in response to the prosecutor's firing. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. has blocked the Biden administration from enforcing Title 42, a Trump-era policy that allows immigration authorities to expel asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border without due process, citing the pandemic as justification. The court's order takes effect in 14 days. It's a landmark victory for the American Civil Liberties Union and several immigrant rights groups who condemn Title 42 as cruel and lawless. The World Meteorological Organization warns in a new report that governments are falling far short of the Paris Climate Agreement's goal of limiting global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius. The UN Weather Agency says only immediate large-scale reductions in greenhouse gas emissions can avert a global catastrophe. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Thursday humanity's future is at stake at the upcoming UN climate change conference in Glasgow, known as COP26.
We continue to destroy the things on which we depend for life on Earth. Ice caps and glaciers continue to melt. Sea level rise is accelerating. The ocean is dying and biodiversity is collapsing. We really are out of time. We must act now to prevent further irreversible damage. COP26 this November must mark that turning point. By then, we need all countries to commit to achieve net zero emissions by the middle of this century and to present clear, credible, long-term strategies to get there.
Meanwhile, a new report by the World Bank warns that without urgent action, the climate crisis could force 216 million people to leave their homes by 2050. Most of the migration will be driven by water scarcity, decreasing crop productivity and rising sea levels. The United States reported more than 3,400 COVID-19 deaths on Thursday, while confirming more than 150,000 new coronavirus infections. One in four U.S. hospitals report their intensive care units are at or near capacity. In Idaho, overwhelmed hospitals Thursday announced they were adopting crisis standards of care to ration health care. That means some people in need of limited resources like ICU beds, ventilators, and supplemental oxygen may be denied care in favor of other patients deemed more likely to survive. The Biden administration's defending its newly announced trilateral security pact with the United Kingdom and Australia, calling it a bulwark against China's power in the Indo-Pacific region. The deal will see the U.S. and Britain transfer nuclear-powered submarine technology to Australia. In Beijing, China's foreign ministry Thursday sharply condemned the new Australia-UK-U.S. partnership, known as AUKUS.
The cooperation between the United States, Britain, and Australia on nuclear-powered submarines has severely damaged regional peace and stability, intensified the arms race, and undermined international nuclear non-proliferation efforts.
France's foreign minister lashed out at the Biden administration over its nuclear submarine deal with Australia, saying that France was blindsided by the U.S. announcement Wednesday.
Parce que cette décision unilatérale.
Because this unilateral, brutal, unpredictable decision reminds me a lot of what Mr. Trump used to do.
C'est vraiment en bon français.
In proper French, this is really a stab in the back. We created a relationship of trust with Australia, and that trust has been broken.
Australia confirmed it's canceling a contract with a French military shipbuilder to build nuclear submarines worth about $65 billion. Meanwhile, anti-war and anti-nuclear groups are denouncing the Australia-UK-US pact. In a statement, Code Pink said, quote, if Biden and the Pentagon really want to ensure peace and stability in the region, they could simply stop dealing missiles, weapons and nuclear tech to Australia, Japan, South Korea and Taiwan, Code Pink said. As Democrats work on hammering out a major infrastructure package and supplementary spending bills, President Biden Thursday said tax hikes on corporations and the ultra rich are both necessary and overdue.
Big corporations and the super wealthy have to start paying their fair share of taxes. It's long overdue. I'm not out to punish anyone. I'm a capitalist. If you can make $1 million or $1 billion, that's great. God bless you. All I'm asking is you pay your fair share.
Earlier this week, House lawmakers advanced a tax plan that would help fund the expansion of the social safety net. The measure would increase the corporate tax rate to 26.5%, and the top individual income tax bracket would see a small rise to 40%. The plan would also raise the capital gains tax rate to 25%, up from the current 20%. In Washington, D.C., police have erected a high metal fence blocking off the Capitol building and grounds ahead of the so-called Justice for J6 rally planned for Saturday. Protest organizers are demanding charges be dropped for violent Trump supporters who attacked Congress on January 6. CNN reports a Department of Homeland Security memo is warning of potential violence around Saturday's rally. In related news, Ohio Republican Congressmember Anthony Gonzalez announced Thursday he will not run for re-election in 2022. Gonzalez was one of just 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach Trump for inciting the January 6th insurrection. After that vote, Gonzalez said he and his family faced threats and had to travel with a security detail. In a statement, Gonzalez said he's leaving Congress in part because of, quote, toxic dynamics inside our own party, the Republican said. In sports news, the U.S. Soccer Federation has announced it's offering the same contract proposals to both the men and women's teams. This follows years of organizing by U.S. women's soccer players who denounced the drastic difference in wages compared to their male counterparts. Several women players sued the U.S. Soccer Federation over gender discrimination. The U.S. women's soccer team has won a record 4 World Cup titles, while the male team has won none. West Africa's main regional bloc, ECOWAS, has enacted sanctions against the military coup leaders in Guinea, demanding the immediate release of ousted President Alpha Conde and for elections to be held in 6 months. The West African leaders also called for elections in Mali by February of next year, saying those responsible for a coup there were holding up a transition to democratic rule. There have been multiple military coups in West and Central Africa since last year in Guinea, Chad, and two in Mali. And in Argentina, tens of thousands of people led a march in Buenos Aires Thursday, protesting the country's economic crisis, chronic unemployment and worsening poverty. This is a labor leader.
Some retirees cannot live, cannot eat despite having worked all their lives. There is a situation of extreme poverty in which 11 million people eat in soup kitchens. There is also an extreme situation in which 5 million people are in severe poverty and do not eat.
The march came days after primary elections were held in Argentina, where the political coalition of President Alberto Fernandez suffered a massive loss, triggering fears Fernandez's government may lose its majority in Congress in November's parliamentary elections. A political crisis is already unfolding, with Vice President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner spearheading what many are calling a cabinet rebellion against President Fernandez. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
Oh, one day I'll be gone. World will keep turning. I hope I leave this place better than I found it. Oh, it's hard, I know it's hard.
to be the lightning in the dark. Hold on tight, you'll be alright. You know it's time. Here comes the change. We're coming of age. This is not a phase. That if I have a child, I hope they live to see the day that everyone's equal. Oh, it's hard, I know it's hard to be the right inside the wrong. Hold on tight.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Some of gymnastics' biggest stars offered scathing testimony Wednesday to the Senate Judiciary Committee about the FBI's failure to stop serial sexual abuser, USA Gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar. Lawyers say in the time between when the FBI was first told of Nassar's crimes and his 2016 arrest, Nassar abused another 120 people. FBI Director Christopher Wray apologized to the gymnasts in the Senate hearing. Last week, the FBI fired an agent involved in the investigation into Nassar. Both the gymnasts and senators on the Judiciary Committee called out Justice Department leadership for failing to appear at Wednesday's hearing. Attorney General Merrick Garland is expected to testify next month. This is the testimony of Simone Biles, the four-time Olympic gold medalist who is widely considered to be the greatest gymnast of all time.
Over the course of my gymnastics career, I have won 25 world championship medals and 7 Olympic medals for Team USA. That record means so much to me, and I am proud of my representation of this nation through gymnastics. I am also a survivor of sexual abuse, and I believe without a doubt that the circumstances that led to my abuse and allowed it to continue are directly the result of the fact that the organizations created by Congress to oversee and protect me as an athlete, USA Gymnastics and the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee, failed to do their jobs. Nelson Mandela once said, there can be no keener revelation of a society's soul than the way in which it treats its children. It is the power of that statement that compels and empowers me to be here in front of you today. I don't want another young gymnast, Olympic athlete, or any individual to experience the horror that I and hundreds of others have endured before, during, and continuing to this day in the wake of the Larry Nassar abuse. To be clear, sorry.
Take your time.
To be clear, I blame Larry Nassar, and I also blame an entire system that enabled and perpetrated his abuse. USA Gymnastics and the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee knew that I was abused by their official team doctor long before I was ever made aware of their knowledge. In May of 2015, Rhonda Fahan, the former head of USA Gymnastics women's program, was told by my friend and teammate, Maggie Nichols, that she suspected I, too, was a victim. I didn't understand the magnitude of what all was happening until the Indianapolis Star published its article in the fall of 2016, entitled, Former USA Gymnastics Doctor Accused of Abuse. Yet while I was a member of the 2016 U.S. Olympic team, neither USAG, USOPC, nor the FBI ever contacted me or my parents. While others had been informed and investigations were ongoing, I had been left to wonder why I was not told until after the Rio Games. This is the largest case of sexual abuse in the history of American sport. And although there have been a fully independent investigation of the FBI's handling of the case, neither USAG nor USOPC have ever been made the subject of the same level of scrutiny. These are the entities entrusted with the protection of our sport and our athletes. And yet it feels like questions of responsibility and organizational failures remain unanswered. As you pursue the answers to those questions, I ask that your work be guided by the same question that Rachel Denhollander and many others have asked. How much is a little girl worth? I sit before you today to raise my voice so that no little girl must endure what I, the athletes at this table, and the countless others who needlessly suffered under Nassar's guise of medical treatment, which we continue to endure today. We suffered and continue to suffer because no one at FBI, USAG, or the USOPC did what was necessary to protect us. We have been failed, and we deserve answers. Nassar is where he belongs, but those who enabled him deserve to be held accountable. If they are not, I am convinced that this will continue to happen to others across Olympic sports. In reviewing the OIG's report, it truly feels like the FBI turned a blind eye to us and went out of its way to help protect USAG and USOPC. A message needs to be sent. If you allow a predator to harm children, the consequences will be swift and severe. Enough is enough.
That's Simone Biles, the four-time Olympic gold medalist, testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee Wednesday about the FBI's failure to stop serial sexual abuser, USA Gymnastics doctor, now imprisoned, Larry Nassar. Biles mentioned Rachel Denhollander, who in 2016 was the first gymnast to publicly speak out against Nassar. On Thursday, Rachel Denhollander spoke to Democracy Now!
I am so proud of the athletes who testified and the light that they're shedding in these dark spaces. But to see over and over and over again the depth of systemic failure and just the incredible damage that was done to them and to all of the survivors who came after they reported when that didn't need to happen is a very heavy burden to bear. And I think something we need to be asking as we're watching this unfold is, what are we not seeing? Because the reality is most survivors of sexual assault who report will tell you that this is a story that they could tell too. It is very difficult to get law enforcement to take reports of sexual assault seriously, to pursue the case with diligence, to prosecute it to the fullest extent of the law. And we need to start looking at what we saw yesterday and ask what we're not seeing. What happens to the survivors who don't have an army of 500 women? What happens to the survivors who don't have Olympians headlining their case and raising the profile of the gross negligence and the corruption that's taking place in our system? In 15 months, the FBI did absolutely nothing except allow over 100 little girls to continue being abused. So we need to be looking at what has to change in this case, but it's not just a problem with this case. We've got to start asking what's got to change in the system, so that survivors that we don't see aren't going through what these women went through and have a justice system that they can truly rely on. Those are hard questions, but they've got to be asked. And these words are cheap if they're not followed by action.
That's Rachel Denhollander, the first gymnast to speak out publicly against Larry Nassar. For more, we're joined by Mark Alicia, who Denhollander first contacted in 2016 when he was part of the investigative team at the Indianapolis Star. She told him, quote, "I'm willing to do anything you need. I want this to end." Mark's team then broke the story about Dr. Nassar's abuse. He is now director of university communications at Indiana State University. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Mark. We talked to you just after Nassar's trial and sentencing, that remarkable moment when one woman, one gymnast after another stood up and talked about how he had wrecked their lives, but talked about surviving. Now we have the top gymnasts, some of the most famous women in the world, like Simone Biles, testifying before the Senate. They specifically focused on the FBI. Tell us this story from the beginning. You were there. How is it that the FBI dropped the ball so completely? And are we going to see criminal charges against FBI agents?
Well, I don't know if we're going to see those charges, but I think it was Senator Leahy who said there are a whole lot of people who ought to be in jail after this. What happened was the FBI did not take the gymnast complaints seriously. They didn't, offices in different cities didn't communicate with each other. And there were conflicts of interest. There was an FBI agent who was talking to the president of USAG, Steve Penny, about getting a job with the U.S. Olympic Committee. Now, and in that they were so chummy that in one of the emails, the Steve Penny told the FBI agent that he would like to, quote, body slam the reporters, myself, Marissa, and Tim. That's Steve Penny. And by the way, he's one of the people who isn't in jail.
So let's talk about why Indianapolis is so important. You mentioned the U.S. Olympic Committee. Talk about who first came forward to the FBI and what happened to that complaint.
That would have been, I believe, Michaela Maroney, very early on. She wasn't taken seriously. I think she testified that the agent said, that's it.
I want to go to the Olympic gold medalist Michaela Maroney testifying before the Senate Wednesday.
This was very clear, cookie-cutter pedophilia and abuse. And this is important because I told the FBI all of this, and they chose to falsify my report and to not only minimize my abuse, but silence me yet again. I thought, given the severity of this situation, that they would act quickly for the sake of protecting other girls. But instead, it took them 14 months to report anything when Larry Nassar, in my opinion, should have been in jail that day. The FBI, USOC, and USAG sat idly by as dozens of girls and women continued to be molested by Larry Nassar.
So, Mark Alicia, talk about how you got involved, the tip, how you ended up going down to Louisville to interview Rachel Denhollander.
My teammates and I, Marissa Kwiatkowski and Tim Evans at the Indianapolis Star, we did a story. The first one was right on the eve of the Rio Olympics in 2016. And after that story came out, we received an email from Rachel saying, I wasn't abused by a coach, but this was a doctor. And if you're interested, I will speak out, and I will speak out by name. I drove down to Louisville, and I interviewed Rachel. She came off as intelligent, sincere, passionate, utterly credible.
Then a lawyer and a mother of three.
And a lawyer and mother of four now, I believe. And yes, everything. And what really, I think, bothers me, it angers me. It doesn't just bother me. It's 5 years after that. It's 5 years after that. And those women had to show up in front of a congressional committee and bare their soul again to make people understand what happened. These survivors, 5 years later, they are still looking for answers. They are still looking for justice. And that's outrageous. And there's another piece to this, too. The survivors also have been trying unsuccessfully to get Michigan State University to release 6,000 pages of documents from an investigation into Nassar that they are withholding because of attorney-client privilege.
Now, this is amazing. Now, Michigan State, the president has had to resign, but he wasn't criminally charged. That's where the, U.S. Olympic Committee's Dr. Nassar worked at Michigan State. And he abused these girls, these young women, for decades.
Right. And it's also important to understand that for about maybe 10 or 15 years earlier, adults gymnasts had come forward to adults to complain about Nassar. But it always went nowhere, and that included one situation with a law enforcement department. It included a Michigan State coach gymnastics coach. It included people who couldn't possibly believe that that great, wonderful Larry Nassar could do such a thing. Adults had failed these children at every level. This is just an absolute tragedy. And again, it is outrageous that 5 years later, it's still going on with so many unanswered questions and so many people who are responsible for allowing Nassar to continue without being held accountable.
I want to go to the three-time Olympic gold medal gymnast, two-time Olympic team captain Ali Raisman, testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee Wednesday.
It is unrealistic to think we can grasp the full extent of culpability without understanding how and why USAG and USOPC chose to ignore abuse for decades, and why the interplay among these three organizations led the FBI to willingly disregard our reports of abuse. Without knowing who knew what when, we cannot identify all enablers or determine whether they are still in positions of power. We just can't fix a problem we don't understand. And we can't understand the problem unless and until we have all of the facts. If we don't do all we can to get these facts, the problems we are here to address will persist. And we are deluding ourselves if we think other children can be spared the institutionalized tolerance and normalization of abuse that I and so many others had to endure.
That is three-time Olympic gold medal gymnast, two-time Olympic team captain Ali Raisman, who has really been the forceful leader of this movement to bring Nassar down, but not only him, because as Simone Biles says, the whole system is broken. But interestingly, the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, did not appear, though the head of the Justice Department was asked to appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Apparently, he's going to appear in October. Christopher Wray did, the head of the FBI, and apologized, though he said he wasn't there at the time. He said it was abhorrent what had taken place. What do you make of this, Mark?
Well, I just, again, I feel so badly for the survivors. I believe it was Ali Raisman who said it's going to take her months just to get over the experience of testifying before the committee, but I'm sure she felt she had a duty to do that. And I would hope that the people at the very top of our judicial system will recognize their duty to these women who have represented our country so well on an international stage. But, you know, I think it's also important, Rachel Den Hollander, kind of typically for her, she can cut straight to the crux of an issue, but she's not just looking at abuse in gymnastics. She is talking about the ordeal of women who report sexual assaults and what they go through in all walks of life.
Especially, I mean, you're talking about gold medalists, world-renowned women. If they are not taken seriously, what is everyone else supposed to think? Last point, Mark Alicia, and it's one you made with us right after the trial, is that these women came forward. It's not like they run track, where it's very clear who wins first, second, and third. The whole sport is judged by committees. And that's where they were incredibly brave in coming forward, because when you rock the boat, these committees don't have to take your scores, your speeds. They can decide if you're a troublemaker or not and ice you out.
Right. And I think by the time a lot of the people who had testified at the Nassar sentencing, they were probably done or close to done with their gymnastics careers. But that's certainly just sort of one factor in a system where people are sort of groomed to be pleasers and, as you said, not to rock the boat, certainly not with their coach.
And you could extend that coach to the workplace. You could extend it certainly to communities, to places of religious worship and beyond. Well, this may well just be the beginning. We'll see where the Senate Judiciary Committee goes. Mark Alicia, we want to thank you so much, reporter with the investigative team at the Indianapolis Star, which broke the story in 2016 about Dr. Nasser's sexual abuse of gymnasts. His team helped to expose USA Gymnastics' failure to report allegations of sexual abuse by coaches and authorities. Now he is no longer with the Indianapolis Star. Coming up, as Congress debates a $3.5 trillion bill to expand the nation's social safety net and to increase taxes on the rich, we look back at Occupy Wall Street, which began 10 years ago today. Stay with us.
Yo, we the 99%. We here, we arrived, and we came to represent. Yo, we the 99%. We here, we arrived, and we came to represent. For the people, for the teachers, for the people. If we knew that, just 1% of these dudes own 2/3 of the U.S. of A. American way. They lock our youth away, right? Commit the same crimes and tell the rest, let them eat cake. In France, they burn cars. In London, they set it off. Well, over here, it's time we march.
I spit for those that have been silenced by the state. They try to silence us like if the party's going late. But I'ma keep it moving for I do this for my fate. Cause you know how I'ma make it, cause you know we feel great. Organizing with the people, organizing with the streets. Because you understand with Wall Street we got beef. They taking all the funds, they taking all the jobs. And people understand that the people are getting hot. I got unemployment lines, it's by design. Lack of dollar signs, economic times. We hard, and everybody knows we representing the Bronx.
Yo, we the 99%. We here, we arrived, and we came to represent. Yo, we the 99%.
Bronx political hip-hop duo Rebel Diaz performing during an Occupy Wall Street march 10 years ago in 2011. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As Congress debates a $3.5 trillion bill to expand the nation's social safety net and to increase taxes on the rich, we look back at Occupy Wall Street, the movement, how it reshaped the national debate on economics and inequality. Yes, it was 10 years ago today, September 17, 2011, when Occupy began. Democracy Now! Was one of the only national outlets to report on the first day of the action. Our producer, Sam Alkoff, filed this report.
On Saturday, thousands of protesters took to the streets of downtown Manhattan for what was described as an action to occupy Wall Street. Inspired by the popular uprisings of the Arab Spring and the European anti-austerity movements, Adbusters, a Vancouver-based culture-jamming magazine, put out a call for Saturday's protest on Wall Street in July. The goals were various, from limiting corporate contributions to political campaigns, to auditing the Federal Reserve, to challenging all of global capitalism. Protesters included 71-year-old Mary Ellen Marino of Princeton, New Jersey.
I came because I'm upset with the fact that the bailout of Wall Street didn't help any of the people holding mortgages. All the money went to Wall Street, and none of it went to Main Street. Now, we've just learned that Geithner was actually asked to split up the Citibank, and he didn't do it, and Obama didn't do anything about it.
The plan wasn't simply for a one-day protest, but an ongoing and creative occupation of the financial district itself. Organizer Lorenzo Serna.
The idea is to have an encampment. Like, this isn't a one-day event. Like, we're hoping that people come prepared to stay as long as they can, and that we're there to support each other.
But on Saturday, after hundreds arrived, the NYPD shut Wall Street down itself, barricading activists off from Wall Street and forcing a move to the nearby Zuccotti Park. Despite sometimes tense standoffs with the police, hundreds slept in the park and have maintained that they will stay until their demands are met.
2 days later, Democracy Now! Interviewed the activist and anthropologist David Graeber, who's been credited with helping to coin Occupy's defining rallying call, "We are the 99%. He talked about how Occupy had been inspired by earlier protests in Europe.
Well, what people are doing in Europe is essentially trying to reinvent democracy. The idea is that, you know, all of the political parties have basically bankrupted themselves. They're all essentially bought and sold by the financial elite that's created this crisis. There's no possibility of their actually coming up with a solution. And essentially, you have to start over. People have to, like, go into their public squares, meet each other, start talking to each other, and start brainstorming of ideas. I mean, essentially, the idea is the system is not going to save us. We're going to have to save ourselves. So we're going to try to get as many people as possible to camp in some public place and start rebuilding society as we'd like to see it.
How many people turned out?
Well, at first we were a little worried at Bowling Green, but more and more people kept showing up. So I ended up helping to facilitate a meeting which was at least 2,000 people. It was mostly young people, and most of them were people who'd gone through the educational system, who were deeply in debt, and who found it completely impossible to get jobs. I mean, these people have felt really feel very strongly that they did the right thing. They did exactly what they were supposed to. The system has completely failed them. And they're not going to be saved by the people in charge. You're just going to have, if there's going to be any kind of society like we worth living in, we're going to have to create it ourselves.
That's David Graeber speaking on Democracy Now, September 19th, 2011, 2 days after the start of Occupy Wall Street encampment. David died last year in Venice, Italy, at the age of 59. Protesters would go on to sleep in Zuccotti Park for nearly 2 months before the New York police raided the encampment. The Occupy movement spread across the nation and the globe, and the impact of Occupy is still being felt in countless ways. We spend the rest of the hour hosting a roundtable looking at the legacy of Occupy. Joining us from Philadelphia is Nalini Stamp, the Director of Strategy and Partnership at the Working Families Party. 10 years ago, she was part of outreach, labor, and facilitation working groups during Occupy Wall Street. She later helped start the Dream Defenders. In Durham, North Carolina, we're joined by Jillian Johnson. 10 years ago, she was a key organizer in Occupy Durham. Today, she serves on the Durham City Council and is Durham's mayor pro tem. And in Asheville, North Carolina, we are joined by writer and filmmaker Astra Taylor, who was involved in Occupy Wall Street and co-edited the Occupy Gazette, which featured reports from occupies around the world. She's also an organizer with the Debt Collective, an organization with its roots in the Occupy Wall Street movement. She's just co-authored a piece in New York Magazine headlined Occupy Wall Street Changed Everything. 10 years later, the legacy of Zuccotti Park has never been clearer. So, Astra, let's begin with you. Talk about how it changed everything and where, how you see it has affected everything today.
Well, to understand how Occupy changed everything, I think we have to remember what it was like before. Occupy sort of broke the spell. It was really hard to talk about class, talk about capitalism, talk about inequality. We were in the world of Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, where there was no alternative to the status quo. It was a kind of, you know, bipartisan consensus around neoliberal capitalism. So, you know, part of what created the conditions for the banking crisis was the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which was a Depression era law. And that was repealed under the Clinton administration. Also, there was, you know, the period after September 11th, 2001, it was very difficult to protest in New York City. Part of what made Occupy seem so improbable was that it was actually illegal to have unpermitted gatherings of more than 20 people. So there was just this, it was, you know, the left was very demoralized. The left was really fragmented and beaten down. And something changed in that year. And it, you know, your reporter touched on this. People were watching these movements around the world, from the Arab Spring to the movement of the squares, the movement of the indignados in Spain and elsewhere. And it's, people started to think, you know, we've got to do something. Maybe we can actually protest and make a difference. And so that, you know, that first day 10 years ago today, you know, I have to say it was, I went to Zuccotti Park, marched from Bowling Green up to Zuccotti Park. And, you know, it was powerful, but not because there were so many people, not because there were thousands and thousands of people, but because it was a space where those of us who felt that things were wrong could come together and meet each other and talk and just, you know, decide we had to express our discontent, had to express our outrage. And so that it was a major shift. And so 10 years later, you know, I think we can see that Occupy kind of inaugurated this social movement renaissance. We've been in an age of defiant protest ever since Occupy Wall Street. The political landscape has really changed. People are now, you know, we have not stopped talking about capitalism. We haven't stopped talking about class. We haven't stopped talking about debt. And, you know, people have figured out how to challenge political establishment. So I think it's had a tremendous legacy. And, you know, its offshoots actually, you know, we've never tallied them up. All over the country, Occupy sprouted different efforts, different initiatives, and changed lives.
Let's go to Nalini Stamp in Philadelphia. You were part, you're now with Working Families Party, but then you were part of the outreach, labor, and facilitation working groups during Occupy Wall Street. Much of the power was the community that was created there. Can you talk about the decision making and why you even chose to go to Occupy Wall Street and how it has shaped you and this country today?
Yeah, I mean, I was, even before Occupy, I was a part of the Working Families Party, but knew the limits of electoral process and work. And I was very skeptical. I wasn't at Bowling Green. I came and rolled in when people were just at Zuccotti already. But what motivated me was something different. There was something different about saying, we're going to stay here and we are going to collectively work together to build another world because we believe another world is possible. So what really, you know, I say this every time I say what really, really hooked me was the General Assembly that evening where people could, as Astra said, tell their stories. And it was the first time I said I was a high school dropout. I hid it for years. I mean, some people knew, but it was the first time I could say to a big crowd, I could not afford to go to college. I wasn't actually one of those people that went to college and came out with the economy. I couldn't even afford it then. And I remember just everybody together collectively up-twinkling because part of it, you know, part of it was direct democracy. And that's, you know, the decision-making, the teams, the working groups, immediately when they said, here are different working groups and you should create more. I felt like I could take ownership of it. That evening, I was like, definitely outreach. I know how to organize. I didn't know about direct action or anything else. And I went to the outreach group. We said we were going to support every single, we wanted to map out every single labor issue and labor dispute in the city of New York, or at least Manhattan, and that we would show up with our cardboard sign saying, you are the 99%. Labor unions are definitely a part of the 99%. And we did. We showed up at the Verizon building when CWA was, the communication workers were fighting against Verizon. We showed up at Sotheby's with the Teamsters. We showed up at so many different labor disputes. And it was something that, because of my background in building, you know, electoral politics with labor, was heard and felt in the labor movement. And they started to open their doors to us so that we could have meetings in places like DC 37 and the communication workers that had offices nearby. And so that was just, it was really beautiful to be able to, for people to have ownership. And I think that was also what was radically different. It wasn't, we're going to tell you what to do. Those facilitators that first night, which included David, which included many of our friends, they were like, this is yours now. Just because we were the folks who were building it, this is yours now. And that revolutionized what movements have come since, where it is everybody's and people can take something and make it their own. So having those processes of general assemblies every evening, now there were problems that happened with that as well. But having that, having direct democracy, coming up with guiding principles together and being free to make decisions in our principles of working. So direct action can make the decisions of the opening and closing bell. Labor can make decisions for this and that and so on and so forth, was actually more inviting for people because people could show up for a couple of days and participate at a higher level than them showing up and being a body in an action. And that was what I think really transformed the way we were able to relate and build with one another.
So Occupy Wall Street wasn't, of course, just in Zuccotti Park. It was all over the country and actually all over the world. Jillian Johnson, you are now the mayor pro tem of Durham, North Carolina. You were a key figure in Occupy Durham. Talk about how you came to that, what you were looking for, how it changed your city, and your choice to get involved with electoral politics afterwards.
So we had heard about the occupation that was happening in Zuccotti Park, and we're following it really closely, the movement community in Durham. And after a couple of weeks, we saw these other occupations sprouting up all over the country. And we were like, well, we got to get in on that. And I think we were just so inspired and excited by the growth of this movement. And it was unprecedented what we were seeing. And so a friend of mine and I, my friend Ben, who had just been kind of following the news and getting more and more excited, just decided to call for an Occupy Durham General Assembly in the middle of our city in a downtown plaza that we quickly renamed the People's Plaza. If anyone's ever been to Durham, it's the one with the giant bull statue. And we had about 400 people show up, and we were just so excited by being able to be a part of this growing global movement. We moved quickly into, you know, starting to have general assemblies, having, you know, more and more people come out, trying to figure out what this looks like in the context of, you know, a mid-sized southern town. Durham at the time had, you know, just over 200,000 people, but was also, you know, beginning to go through some serious economic struggles, gentrification, housing displacement. There were a lot of people in Durham who were really struggling. And so we really resonated with the message that was coming out of New York and with the same conversations that people were having about income inequality, about housing inequality. I ran for office just 4 years after Occupy in 2015. And I think at first it was kind of a leap of faith. I didn't really have a sense that I was going to be able to change things from an elected position. I was hoping that there was an opportunity there. And I think our movement was starting to turn more and more toward the idea that electoral politics could provide some opportunities for us to make change and to leverage resources for the benefit of working class and communities of color. And I've been able to do that in ways that I didn't expect. I think the transition has been, it's been difficult in ways, but it's also been very empowering and exciting to be able to put my organizing skills and movement skills to work in a different context. And I think bringing more people into the electoral world through some of the work I'm doing with a national organization called Local Progress, and just folks, you know, in my community, talking to other movement people, younger people who might be interested in moving into the electoral realm someday. I've felt like I've been able to gain skills and knowledge, and then pass those skills and knowledge on to other people within the movement. So it's felt really rewarding, difficult, of course, at times, but ultimately I feel like I've been able to do something good in this position, and I'm excited about passing the torch on to somebody else.
I want to go to a few months later, November 2011, during the Occupy protests, about 1,000 students marching in New York City outside a meeting where CUNY trustees, that's City University of New York trustees, voted to authorize annual tuition increases. This is Julian Guerrero of Students United for a Free CUNY.
Me, myself.
I'm in debt $70,000.
I'm in debt $70,000.
I actually got a letter.
From Sally Mae.
Saying that if I don't start paying today.
$900 a month.
$900 a month.
Going to have more aggressive attempts at collecting my debt. To burn this right here and now.
So that's Julian Guerrero of Students United for a Free CUNY, using the whole idea of the mic check and the open mic and the mic repeats that we've come to see that are so familiar. Astra Taylor, you are a key member of the Debt Collective. Talk about how that movement has evolved to today.
Now, the Debt Collective is an organization for debtors that fights for the cancellation of all kinds of debt and the provision of the services, the public goods we all need to survive and thrive. It has its roots directly at Occupy Wall Street. So just like Nalini felt that space to talk about her condition, honestly, you know, for many of us who are in debt, Occupy was a similar space where we could see that we were not alone. And that is actually the Debt Collective slogan. You are not alone, a space, L-O-A-N, right? A space where we could come together. And debt was actually part of the protests around the world at the time. Tuition hikes sparked protests in Latin America. And later in Quebec, there was a wave of protests. And so, you know, we followed the threads of debt once the parks were cleared, because how we were thinking about a time was, you know, yes, we're occupying Wall Street, but Wall Street occupies our lives. And how does it do that? Often in the form of debt. We're forced to debt finance things that should be publicly provided. And it was at Occupy Wall Street that we had the collective epiphany. We started to recognize that our debts, which are so burdensome, could actually be a potential source of power, a source of leverage. And by consistently organizing, you know, we've moved the needle on that issue. I think, you know, we now are in a world where leading politicians talk about student debt cancellation. The Debt Collective has won $1 billion of loan cancellation for debtors. And that demand started at Occupy Wall Street. And the media was very skeptical. They mocked the demand. They said it's never going to happen. Isn't Occupy so naive? Well, look where we are today. We've really moved the debate. And so that is what, you know, I think that's a really concrete result of this movement.
I want to go to the issue of police repression of Occupy protests across the country. On November 18th, 2011, campus police officers at the University of California, Davis pepper sprayed peaceful student protesters. Video of the police attack went viral.
Don't shoot students! Don't shoot students!
I wasn't aware I was going to be pepper sprayed until people told me to protect myself. I mean, I have friends who are pepper sprayed who said they did not know that that was happening and that that was coming. And we were expecting to be shot in the back with something because they were behind us. And we really had no idea what was going to happen.
That's UC Davis student Elle Pearson speaking on Democracy Now! After she was pepper sprayed. And you have the whole coordination. It later came out. I remember that piece in The Guardian by Naomi Wolf revealed how the FBI coordinated the crackdown on Occupy, the destruction of Occupy Wall Street and other places all over the country, well over a dozen cities. Nalini Stamp, if you can talk about what you understand took place and how the police dealt with you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was interesting because very early on that first weekend, I remember going to an officer and saying, can my friend's car be there? And they're like, yeah, y'all will be gone by Monday. And increasingly, as soon as we started, one of the first regular direct actions we did at Occupy Wall Street was the opening and closing bell. We would march for the opening bell and closing bell of the stock exchange in Wall Street. And that first Monday, we started getting shoved and pushed. And every single day that we were out there, things escalated to then, you know, a few arrests, to then a few more arrests. And I think things really changed on the Saturday. There was a few things that I feel like people don't understand what happened those first 2 weeks also in the nation. Troy Davis was executed by the state of Georgia. A huge case of misjustice on racial reckoning again. There was a huge debate in the city of New York around stop and frisk. And so all of these tensions were underlying. But there was also this idea and original sentiment to say that the cops are the 99% too, because most of them were not making, if we were really a uniting movement. So it was this really interesting juxtaposition that was happening those first 2 weeks. And that Saturday, we did weekly actions on Saturday, and I don't remember if it was the 24th or the, I usually used to remember all of the dates in my mind. We took the streets. And it was civil disobedience like New York hasn't seen in a really long time. And I remember getting to Union Square and all of a sudden they had this orange netting all around us, which I think is now illegal in the city of New York for cops to do. But they had orange netting and pepper spray was just going everywhere. And that was kind of I think that was a radicalizing moment for a lot of the our white comrades at Occupy Wall Street, who never had to deal with the police, as those of us who come from communities of color in New York had to, or those of us who have a history of, when I was younger, I remember seeing Amadou Diallo's murder on every single thing and people marching on the Brooklyn Bridge. And so for those who didn't have that background or that personal experience, they finally did have that. And that's when I think there was this awakening of a lot of young, young white folks or more affluent folks who didn't come from over-policed communities actually saying and trying to hold the police accountable. So what you see is right after Occupy Wall Street, you see Ramarlee Graham gets killed in the city of New York, and then Trayvon Martin gets killed in Florida, and people start to act up. You know, I flew down to Florida because they wanted somebody to train them in direct action and helped co-found the Dream Defenders. We marched for miles to Sanford. And then you see a big march in June of 2012 with 50,000 people that said end stop and frisk. And I don't think that would have been, that would have had the new people involved as it did if we didn't have so much like repression from the state. And I think part of it was to make people not come out, to make people were really threatened by Occupy at that time. And I think that that's what ended up happening. And it was really beautiful to see people get involved and actually call out police brutality after that.
Nalini Stamp, I want to thank you for being with us. This has to end this discussion today. Nalini Stamp of Working Families Party in Philadelphia, Astor Taylor of the Debt Collective speaking to us from Asheville, and Jillian Johnson, Mayor Pro Tem of Durham, North Carolina, all three involved in the Occupy movement 10 years ago. And we continue to cover it when we look at the bills that are in Congress right now and so much more. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The Association des Services de Réhabilitation Sociale du Québec is filing a class action suit. If you were strip searched between July 13, 2006 and July 1, 2011, if you were in one of the following facilities, Bordeaux, Rivière-des-Prairies, Roberval, Saint-Jérôme, or the male sector of Quebec City, you may be able to be part of this claim. For complete details, go to asrsq.ca/class action. That's asrsq.ca/class action. Claims must be filed before January 16th, 2022.
The CKUT Programming Committee is responsible for CKUT programming. If you have any specific complaint regarding anything you have heard on air at 90.3 FM in Montreal, please outline the nature of the complaint along with the precise program date and time. Letters must be signed with full name and current address of the individual or individuals lodging the complaint. Postal or personal deliveries only. CKUT's address is 3647 University Street in Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. The committee is committed to ensure listener complaints are given serious consideration. Listener feedback can be left at the following number: 514-448-4041, extension 2547.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
En la pandemia, nuestros niños demostraron lo fuertes, pacientes y resilientes que pueden ser. Llegó el momento de que vuelvan a disfrutar de la niñez. Junto a familiares y amigos, con sus compañeros de equipo, junto a otros niños. La vacunación contra la COVID-19 puede ayudar a que los niños vuelvan a ser niños. Protege a tus hijos y a quienes los rodean. Programa sus citas de vacunación cuando la vacuna esté disponible para ellos. Un mensaje del Gobierno de Canadá.
Throughout the pandemic, our kids have shown how strong, patient, and resilient they can be. But now, it's time for them to make memories again. With family and friends, with teammates, with peers. Vaccination against COVID-19 can help kids get back to being kids. Help protect your child and those around them. Book your child's vaccination when it's available to them. A message from the Government of Canada.
L'élection fédérale aura lieu le lundi 20 septembre. Vous pouvez voter d'avance. Les bureaux de vote par anticipation seront ouverts du 10 au 13 septembre. Si vous le préférez, vous pouvez faire une demande pour voter par la poste ou voter à un bureau d'Élections Canada avant le mardi 14 septembre, 18h. Consultez votre carte d'information de l'électeur pour connaître